Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. We're going to open this hour by speaking with our friend Andrea Picciotti-Bear, who joins us every Wednesday. Today we're going to be talking about the Supreme Court ruling in favor of a group of Maryland parents who objected to their children being subjected to a collection of storybooks imbued with LGBTQ+ content. This case is Mahmoud versus Taylor. We talked about it briefly sometime in the past. Well, on Friday, just this past Friday, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of these parents. And we're going to take a look at the case because it has to do with the courage of these parents in fighting for the prevention of the exposure of their children to content that violates their religious belief, even within a public school sphere. Because it's a question of how and when their children will be given classes that discuss family life, human sexuality. And the whole premise here is the respecting of the parents' right to opt their children out of content that they deem not fitting for the formation of their children due to things like moral and especially religious concerns. So we'll talk about that with Andrea Picciotti-Bear. We go on from there to speak with Dr. John Nunez. Dr. John Nunez is president of California Lutheran University, and I had a really enlightening conversation with him at Acton University 2025. The question is the purpose of education. What does it achieve when it is done right, and what does it fail to achieve when it's done wrong? And we have to understand that when we talk about education, we are looking at something that is an avenue for the formation of the soul so that we can understand that the end of education is more than a high-paying job. Sure, it can lead to employment, don't get me wrong here, but if we believe that the end of education, the telos of education, is for the sake of a high paycheck at the end of the day, we've lost the meaning, we've lost the point for why we educate at all. And so Dr. John Nunez understands the importance of mission-driven education, and that's what we want to reassess so that hopefully we as a faithful Christian body can reclaim that as part of our conversation. And finally, we speak with Joseph Stewart about Christopher Dawson, the Catholic cultural historian who understood culture to be a medium, a substance in the middle which forces act. Talk about all of this after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Wednesday, July 2nd. It's the Feast of St. Bernardino Riolino. Today's news is brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need. VisitingAngels.com. Prosecutors will seek about 4 to 5 years in prison for Sean Diddy Combs, the New York jury finding him guilty of transporting people for prostitution, but not guilty of sex trafficking and racketeering, so he can be released on bond until sentencing. In court today, prosecutors telling the judge that sentencing guidelines range from 51 to 63 months, adding they still don't want bond given to the rap mogul. A priest in Mexico is in critical condition after being wounded by gunfire. The Diocese of Tabasco reporting that Father Hector Perez was shot while traveling to visit a sick parishioner in an apparent case of mistaken identity. At least 7 people are unaccounted for after a warehouse full of fireworks exploded in Northern California. It happened yesterday evening, rocking the town of Espardo about 40 miles north of Sacramento and sending plumes of smoke billowing some 15,000 feet into the air. The Wisconsin State Supreme Court is blocking a state abortion ban from going into effect. The 1849 near total abortion ban had technically retaken effect after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. However, abortion providers in the state resumed the procedure in 2023. Wisconsin Supreme Court judges 4-3 along ideological lines to affirm the lower court's ruling that overturned the ban and left in place a more recent law allowing more abortions until about the 20th week of pregnancy. And a child from Cajun country in Louisiana is one step closer to being recognized as a saint. Charlene Richard was 12 years old when she died of leukemia in 1959, the Vatican approving an investigation into her life. If the church is impressed with her virtue, a miracle through her intercession will be needed to move her forward to beatification. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. This past Friday, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of a group of Maryland parents who objected to their children being subjected to a collection of storybooks imbued with LGBTQ content that undermines the tenets of the faith. We talk about this with our friend Andrea Picciotti-Bear, legal analyst for EWTN News and director of the Conscience Project. You can follow her work at conscience-project.org. Andrea, thank you for joining us. How are you?
I'm doing great, Marcus. I think we're winning, and we're just keep winning. Every week, you and I are getting together and talking about these great wins for religious freedom, for families, and for the protection of children.
Before we talk about this particular area of winning, I want to congratulate you for winning the Religious Freedom Impact Award of 2025 from the RFI. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much. It's super and a super honor for me. I just love the folks at the Religious Freedom Institute in Washington, D.C. They've been doing great promoting religious freedom here at home and abroad. And it's, well, it's all for his glory, right?
Yeah.
So it's humbling for me, but a great chance to put a spotlight on the beauty of faith and the protection of its exercise.
Yep. And honestly, I can think of no one better to have honored for that award. So truly happy for you, celebrating and rejoicing. And that leads us to more happy news. So Mahmoud versus Taylor. Again, in the interest of our listeners, I think we need to provide them some context. Again, I mentioned in the open, but for the sake of our listeners.
Yeah, no, this has been a crazy case for a couple of years, mm-hmm. where Montgomery County, Maryland, just a stone's throw away from our nation's capital, the school board there put together a collection of storybooks for very young learners, for pre-K to sixth grade, and this collection was the Pride storybooks. It was woven throughout the English literature curriculum of the school, and it had just really kind of shocking themes, asking even, you know, kids that don't even know how to read yet to find images like drag queen and leather, especially pushing gender ideology, questioning parents, even questioning biological reality. A number of parents of faith asked for notice of when the books would be used and the chance to opt out, and they were told that they couldn't.
Yeah.
Even though the state, like many states in the country, allow for opting out of, you know, family and health classes, they wouldn't allow these parents to opt their children out of exposure to these very ideological driven books. Well, the Supreme Court vindicated their right under the First Amendment Free Exercise Clause, and it's quite an important case, I think, for the court's continued religious freedom jurisprudence.
Yep.
But more significantly, it comes really importantly for these young kids in Maryland.
You know, the argument of these parents seems to be very well founded: Free Exercise Clause, Due Process Clause, First Amendment parental rights, but it's amazing the district court and the Fourth Circuit just dismissed the case outright.
Yeah, you know, it was really kind of shocking that the Court of Appeals said, you know, we're really not sure what kind of injury is going to happen, so come back to us later. Because the parents were asking for a preliminary injunction, asking that they would be able just to know when the books would be read. They weren't asking that the books not be included at all. They just were asking to shield their own children. It really does take this Supreme Court a chance to kind of redirect the lower courts, reaffirm that when it comes to critical First Amendment rights, you don't have to wait for the injury to happen to get judicial relief, because once that injury has happened, really it's irreparable harm.
Yeah.
But you can ask for an injunction before books are placed, but they were already, you know, being used. They weren't just stagnant, standing on the bookshelves, but instead the school board had directed teachers to use them. Even teachers didn't have the chance to opt out of using them, despite the fact that multiple principals in the county schools said these were just age inappropriate. not even taking on the issue of gender ideology being suspect. They just said these topics aren't for young kids to be exposed to.
You know, as alarming as this is, one can easily say, wow, that's a tremendous violation of First Amendment rights. But you can also consider the fact that the policy by itself tremendously burdens the free exercise right of parents, that the school didn't even take that into consideration.
You know what was interesting is they kind of brushed it off, saying our administrative concerns are more important. And they said it'd be really hard. This is where the irony comes in, Marcus. It'd be really hard to allow parents to opt out because so many parents have indicated that they don't want their children reading these books.
Really?
It was a really strange kind of emperor has no clothes kind of moment where...
Yeah.
Where you'd think, if so many families in your school district don't want this, why are you pushing it?
Right.
But progressive ideology is geared towards indoctrination, right. And it's very intolerant. And ideas, for example, of putting the interest of children who identify as trans, which I still think is, you know, just not possible unless
yep.
there's been some sort of strange intervention. But those children have a right that is superior to the right, the religious freedom rights that are actually enshrined in the Constitution is just very, very strange. And fortunately, the Supreme Court wasn't buying it.
Yep. And I'm really glad for that because I guess it should come to as no surprise to me that Justice Sotomayor was one of the dissenting justices. But I'm glad for where the Supreme Court landed because it's again, very clear, like you mentioned, many parents want to opt out, and so the school board just decides as a kind of paternalistic right, no, this is what's best, and you don't get a say in the matter. And again, violating First Amendment rights, burdening free exercise rights of parents, I'm just flabbergasted. I'm just glad that justice has been done.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I would give, you know, two particular shout-outs from the majority here. First, the court's, the author of the court's majority opinion, Justice Samuel Alito, folks will know that name as he was the author of the important Dobbs decision that reversed Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote just a very powerful reaffirmation of the role of parents. And Justice Clarence Thomas also kind of took on the public school system for pushing
yeah.
progressive ideology that has nothing to do with education
yeah.
and everything to do with indoctrination. They bravely are the voices we should be listening to. As for the dissenting voices, I think we can just ignore them.
I agree with you. I want to read something Justice Alito wrote. To compel children to absorb teachings that directly contradict their family's faith without opportunity to dissent or opt out is to place the state's ideology over religious liberty, something our Constitution does not permit. I mean, talk about words of hope here.
Yes, no, you're absolutely right. And what's really interesting is for many progressive education advocates, I guess, they think that the schools are above the parents. We know as Catholics that parents are the primary educators,
yep.
and that's actually a concept that the Constitution reaffirms. Just 100 years ago, there was an important decision, Pierce versus Society of Sisters, where Catholic nuns stood up for parents' rights to choose parochial education instead of mandated public school education. So this isn't anything new. This is really core to our American tradition, and blessed be God, we have a constitution to protect parents from this kind of overreach by school administrators.
I love Professor Helen Alvarez's comment on this, that this decision is a return to first principles, so therefore a return to logic. The court is reminding the nation that conscience and the family are not government-defined categories.
Yeah, no. Professor Alvarez, anyone that's interested in knowing where to go on particular issues, follow Helen Alvarez. She's, you know, sharp as a tack and is always very keen on this. She was part of a number of academics that filed a brief in the case. Their work was cited, I think, by Justice Thomas in his concurring opinion.
Mm.
And it really is a testament to the important role of Catholics in our intellectual tradition helping shape the culture.
Yep. There's no way around it. This has been a historic ruling, and I look forward to more successes such as these. Thank you, Andrea, for your time.
Thank you, Marcus. Have a good evening.
You too. My guest has been Andrea Pejorti-Bear, legal analyst for EWTN News. She also recently received the RFI Award for the Year. And congratulations to her, the Freedom Impact Award. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Hi, this is Ed Bahura with Silva Learning Centers. This is one of our many five-star Google reviews.
I would like to take the time to thank all of the staff at Sylvan for helping my daughter achieve her goal of attending the University of Michigan Ann Arbor with a full scholarship. My daughter has been able to maintain all A's in math and increased her SAT score by 200 points as a result of attending Sylvan.
To learn more, call 1-800-EDUCATE or visit sylvanlearning.com.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. As I've mentioned before, I'm coming to you from Acton University 2025. This is a wondrous place of exchange for ideas pertaining to the biblical worldview at the intersection of reason, faith, culture, politics, economics, and all areas of human flourishing. Joining me to talk about the mission of the mission-driven higher education and the future of it is John Arthur Nunez. He has served for more than 30 years as a leader of academic institutions and nonprofit organizations, and most recently, he is the president of California Lutheran University. John, thank you for joining us. How are you?
Great to be here with you, Dr. Peter. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Well, thank you very much for making the time. The pleasure and delight is all mine. And this topic that you're on the panel for is something that's near and dear to my heart as a man who reads history and reads the culture and what God's trying to do. And I think I want to start with the reality of what some might call academic bloat. And I don't mean that in terms of administrative bloat. What I mean is we've created a kind of cultural milieu where the expectation is everyone has to go to college or something to that effect. And you've got institutions, not like California Lutheran, but especially public institutions, that seek to deconstruct a transcendental worldview, right? The public university system does that. In the face of this, people like you are at the forefront of showing that it is the Judeo-Christian worldview that creates the avenues for true human flourishing. So I'd like to begin there.
What a large question. Which part should I take a piece of first? Thank you very much for that. So I would say that there's an enduring quality to education. The two oldest institutions in Western civilization are the church and our institutions of higher education. Mm-hmm. And I do agree with you, Dr. Peter, that in many regards and respects, the basic value proposition of a higher education, is it worth the cost? Mm-hmm. Does everyone have to go, to your second point, is under suspicion and is under scrutiny. And rightly so. I think institutions in the higher education sector need to perform better mm-hmm. in terms of delivering what it is that they promise. But I would maintain the greatest anti-poverty program we have, in at least the United States of America, is to get a college degree.
Yep.
It changes the trajectory of your life, and not only yours, but the life of your children and your progeny. So I'm holding out that the long arc of faith-based higher educational institutions is far from over.
Yep.
And there's a reason for that, and it has to do with what you teed up, namely this notion of human flourishing.
Yeah. And in fact, you bring up that crucial point: faith-based liberal arts education, faith-based education that teaches the human person how to be truly human. In a utilitarian perspective, in a secularist perspective, it's no wonder that these large secular universities are thriving now financially, but failing in the long run in terms of their ability to give meaning and substance to the lives of their students.
This is why the humanities matter. You know, they got the word human right in them. And the humanities are the human ties, which humanize us. To know the stories that Alistair MacIntyre talks a lot about, knowing the stories and to seeing ourselves in the stories, and a fundamental narrative in which we are merely participants, gladsome and grateful participants.
Yeah.
And so I agree with you entirely that there is something about liberal arts, humanities, that makes a difference, especially when it's grounded in faith and virtue.
That's the crucial key. Even amongst Christ-believing individuals, faithful individuals across the United States, the narrative we've been sold is that it is the big name universities that's going to give our children a fighting chance. Unfortunately, you send your children there, and it's almost a systematic targeted attack to deconstruct the faith that you worked 18 years to build up. Do you have an insight, both as president of California Lutheran, but also as a husband, as a father, and as someone who's concerned about this issue?
Here's what I do know. Mm-hmm. I know that institutions like California Lutheran University will pay attention to your children, will know your children by name, will care deeply about who they are and their core identity, and will provide them with a nurturing environment. I'm excited about the students I meet and the way in which they flourish on our campus and then in life in the world. And it's thrilling to receive, you know, letters and communication back from students, and they just tell you about the difference that an education has made in their life.
Which comes to that question of mission-driven higher learning. Can there be real higher learning without a mission that supersedes the institution?
Isn't that a fabulous question? And I guess we could talk for the rest of the day on that question. I don't think so. That's why I am committed to an entity that has a transcendent view of who or what is the human person and has an answer to that question.
Yeah.
That all people created in the image and the likeness of God, bearing dignity and value and meaning and purpose, and that life cannot be reduced to a kind of scientific materialism,
right,
or it can't be reduced to, and this is why the word flourishing is so important. Mm-hmm. You used that word earlier. That has much more to, that means so much more than just fleeting giddiness or happiness, much more than just achieving some kind of socioeconomic success in life.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, if that's all we achieve, we have failed. It's whole person education that we're about.
What you've shed light on, therefore, raises the further question about K-12 education. Short of sending your child to a faith-based, or even at the lowest level, some kind of a liberal arts institution, right? But short of sending your child to one of those iterations, the public schooling system is primarily utilitarian, materialist, empiricist, but also progressivist. It's virtually ubiquitous at this point. A lot of the students that you're probably receiving at California Lutheran sometimes come from these backgrounds. I'd just like to invite you to speak to that.
I don't fully understand what's happening in public schools, but this I know, that the core mediating institution where faith is nurtured and shared and conveyed and defended is the family.
Mm.
And it's the hardest work that we do, and it's the most important work that we do. I think St. Mother Teresa was exactly right. If you want to change the world, go home and love your family. So I believe that the family can be a buffer in terms of what the culture, I think that's the question you're kind of teeing up here, in terms of what the culture is introducing into the lives of young people. And somehow, young people have to learn how to navigate and negotiate that fundamental transaction. And even if you provide them with the best, you know, schools where you know, there's a total alignment of faith and life and faith and reason, I still say that it boils down to what's happening at home,
yeah,
and what's happening in the family.
Which then helps us draw back to this final consideration. Many of our listeners right now are themselves parents or grandparents. So they have potential or already college-age students. Would you please say a word of exhortation amidst the voice of the culture that tells them, send your child to a big-name secular university? What, like you mentioned, the education of the whole person.
We cannot squander this heritage that we've received. As a philosopher once said, what you have as heritage, take now as task. And the heritage that we've been given is one that we are now responsible to steward and to work in the world. I would say, you know, be careful when you make these choices.
Yeah.
These choices have implications. Choices have consequences. And, yeah, we have freedom, but, you know, that's part of the problem, is that we've reduced freedom to just a matter of choice.
Mm.
And choice ought to be a benefit of freedom, but not the essence of freedom. One of the things I love about the Acton Institute, where you are right now, is that it's about a free society, or freedom, and virtue. And so that kind of core virtue question is one that I would say is the pinpoint of the exhortation, that lives are aligned with integrity, with what we believe, teach, confess, and then live in the world.
It was sublime and beautiful. Thank you very, very much. I've been talking with Dr. John Arthur Nunez. He is president of California Lutheran University, and he's one of the panelists of the panel, The Future of Mission-Driven Higher Education. And we've been talking about exactly that, and the need to understand the sole purpose of higher education, which is the formation of the whole person. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit avemariafunds.com.
We all know that something is eternal, and it ain't houses, and it ain't names, and it ain't earth, and it ain't even the stars. Everybody knows in their bones that something is eternal, and that something has to do with human beings. Those are the famous words from the stage manager of Thornton Wilder's three-act play, Our Town. And in that play, each character strives to find the eternal in what they do or might do, in giving famous speeches and traveling to exotic places and connecting themselves to the glories of a great nation. But as Emily, the main character, too late discovers, the eternal is not in what we do, but in what we are. That painful discovery is in her final futile words to her mother. Just for a moment now, we're all together. Just for a moment, we're happy. Let's look at one another. Herein is the fundamental message of the pro-life movement. The eternal is in each of us. Let's look at one another. GuadalupeWorkers.org.
Throughout my faith journey, I have been given great advice. I've read or heard about ways to pray, especially when we're struggling with our own issues and vices. When I was younger, my father used to always tell me to pray for those who have hurt me. Today, I offer my Eucharist to those who have offended me or angered me. I also pray for people who struggle in similar ways that I do. This is one of my favorite prayer suggestions, and this is how it works. If you're someone with anger issues, pray for others who have anger issues, even those who might be angry with you. If you're a jealous person, pray for someone who's also jealous, even more jealous than you. And if you're someone who tends to gossip, pray for gossipers. see, we're not alone. We all have vices, and it's through prayer we can turn them into virtues. This has been a Christ-centered communication message. I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, a communications evangelist and host of Epiphany.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria, Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at AveMaria.com. That's AveMaria.com.
Hi, I'm Father Chris Alar of the Marian Fathers of the Immaculate Conception. My new book, Understanding the Sacraments, unpacks the extraordinary gifts unique to the Catholic Church. Ever wonder why we baptize infants? Is confession in the Bible? And must wives be subordinate to their husbands? The answers to these more hot-button questions about the sacraments are on sale now from Marian Press at shopmercy.org. God bless you.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. The Catholic cultural historian Christopher Dawson understood culture to be a medium, a substance in the middle through which forces act. In Dawson's political writings, culture mediated between church and state and refracted the light of transcendent truths into particular places, times, and spheres. We talk about this idea with Joseph Stewart. Joseph is professor of history and fellow in Catholic studies at the University of Mary in Bismarck. He's also the author of several books, including Christopher Dawson, A Cultural Mind in the Age of the Great War. Joseph, great to speak with you. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you, Dr. Peter?
It's great to speak with you, and I'm doing very, very well. And our mutual love for the work of Christopher Dawson is an exciting reason to connect. And so, Joseph, oh, by the way, my sister graduated from the University of Mary, so I've got vested interest in your place of employment as well.
Wonderful.
Now, I want to begin by talking about this notion of Dawson's political theory, how he viewed the operations of the political sphere, of governance in light of the societal sphere, and the role that culture played as a kind of lubricating force in between.
Christopher Dawson, he wrote on history early in his career, mm-hmm. and the social sciences, but along about the 1930s, when totalitarianism was spreading across much of the world, this was a key time for Catholics to rethink their approach to politics, and so he began to realize that that the Catholics needed to broaden their minds a little bit and work with anybody of goodwill, whether they're Catholic or not, to try to defend the basic human rights of religious freedom and human dignity, the right to life. And so that began sort of a broadening of a Catholic approach to politics, and Dawson was part of that. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that I have found so fascinating in his work, is the way that he still today is so relevant because of his focus on culture and working together with other common like-minded people to defend the really important human and permanent things.
And so when we think about the way, like you mentioned, these really important things about, in this case, culture as a kind of medium, he starts seeing that religion really has a place, church really has a place in the building of culture, and in the cultus of worship informs the way culture develops within society.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. And I think that what he's trying to say is, he's trying to get us out of this kind of binary thinking, mm-hmm. of, in our country, Republican versus Democrat, liberal versus, conservative, and maybe Catholic against secular or something.
Right,
he's trying to pull us out of this kind of dichotomy and bring us into a place where there is something that's mediating between different peoples. Right. And so culture as a medium is in saying, well, look, we may not agree with our neighbors about everything, but we share a neighborhood and we care about the safety of our children walking to school. And there's key human things that we can work together to try to solve those problems. And Dawson is pointing us to that third factor, that culture as a medium between other extremes.
And so when we think about Dawson's impact on culture and politics, we can also consider certain issues that plague modernity to this day as well, but in sort of subtle undercurrents. You know, you've got issues of anywhere from Christian nationalism to this post-liberalism, you know, this Catholic integralism that we're seeing coming out of certain academic spheres. And so in the face of this, Dawson actually does provide us not just a corrective, but also a virtuous balance of how to approach the topic properly.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I think that's right. And I think because one of the problems I see today is that many conservatives and Catholics, you know, look at the liberal world and they want to react against it. And the problem with that is that you end up running into other errors.
Mm.
And so we have to be aware always that there's two extremes. You know, Aristotle and Aquinas talk about the two extremes,
right,
and the virtue is in the middle. And Dawson is helping to find out where the middle is, where the medium is. And so he wants to take us out of that kind of reactionary spirit. And he wants us to realize that, look, that if we say, okay, on the one hand, the state is everything and should be in charge, and then you react and say, no, it should be the state, that the church is in charge, should be in charge of everything, like the integralists would say,
right,
you say, no, this is a false dichotomy, and this is not a really Christian way of thinking about politics.
Right. And okay, but we also need to be very honest. He's diagnosing the problem because he also realizes in a society that allows for liberty, it's very easy for the individual to detach himself from the work of the common good and to become what he called fall into anarchic individualism. And then when you do that, you've relegated the work of culture to either purely ecclesial authorities or political governance.
Yeah, that's right. And so we get lazy and we think, oh, things are going really bad, and so therefore we just need to have, you know, the culture controlled by, you know, the church or something. And Dawson's saying, no, like, this is giving up on the Holy Spirit. Like, the culture is the sphere in which the Holy Spirit operates through the lay people, particularly everybody, but particularly the lay people. And so this anarchic individualism, yes, it's a problem, but the answer is not giving over control to either the church or the state.
Right.
The answer is a conversion, and all of us working in our vocations to influence that wider culture and inspire people to pay attention to the myriad ways the Holy Spirit is trying to work among us.
And that's precisely why we can start, if you affirm this way of thinking, this virtuous way of thinking, you start seeing that the freedoms we take for granted are themselves gifts of the Holy Spirit. You know, Dawson would talk about your freedom of worship, your freedom of speech, the freedom from want, and therefore freedom from fear. These are things that the Holy Spirit has endowed us as a result of an affluent nation.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. And I think that he's saying, look, that there's a temptation here for us is to, we want to subordinate the cultural sphere to either ecclesiastical power or political power. And he's saying, no, this is a misunderstanding of the kingdom of God. He's saying that the kingdom of God is a leaven that exists underneath the surface of the present order to transform it. And a leaven, this was in a homily recently, Dr. Peter, I thought it was wonderful. Leaven is a very humble thing. It's not like you have a really good bread that's leaven informs, and then you don't eat the bread and say, oh, that's a really good leaven. you say, that's a really good piece of bread, right? And so it's almost like the vocation of the Christian in the kingdom of God often, not always, but often is a kind of disappearing one. It's like we do our work and we enable the wider world to kind of be brought back into what it can do. Like, in other words, restoring the true powers of nature, of the natural order that God has created. Grace is needed because of original sin to restore the true natural order. And that's what the leaven does. And the leaven then sort of dissipates and disappears, and then the beautiful natural order appears. I think that's the deepest level at which Dawson is trying to challenge us.
And so in the mind of Dawson, you're an academic, you're an intellectual individual, and so someone like you would have a role in society, almost a primary thrust, to serve the common good by means of the upbuilding of an intellectual ethos, you know, the universal community of thought, and not causing political faction. Considering the fact that there are many people in positions like yourself who don't honor that role, just speak to this as an academic, this almost irreverence for the role that you play.
Yeah, that's, you know, Dawson has written other essays on intellectuals and the role of intellectuals, and so often we intellectuals get sort of co-opted by the political ideology mm-hmm. of the day, or social ideologies. And we do research, but we actually do the research simply to justify the ideological position we already have, right? And Dawson and others, and the church and many others of goodwill, constantly kind of challenge the intellectual to say, no, like, you need to believe in a truth that's deeper than just the assumptions of the present day. And in fact, the truth that transcends the academy, for sure, but also even our own country, and transcends to a wider sort of universality in which an intellectual should be able to have a camaraderie and a common concern even with other intellectuals in Canada or France or China or wherever, that because truth is transcendent. And so I think we need to come back to that idea of the importance of finding and defending a wider truth in the places where we are.
And we're continuing this conversation on the other side of the break. I'm talking with Joseph Stewart, professor of history and fellow in Catholic studies at the University of Mary in Bismarck, North Dakota. He's also the author of numerous books, including Christopher Dawson, A Cultural Mind in the Age of the Great War. And he's whom we're talking about right now, Christopher Dawson, The Medium of Culture in Political Theory. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Beckway Door is a top provider of garage doors as well as home entry, patio, and storm doors. Locally owned since 1978, we give free, no-pressure quotes at prices 20% lower than most competitors, and often provide same-day service for garage door repairs. Mention Ave Maria Radio for 10% off the replacement or service of your garage door or the installation of new exterior doors. Visit BeckwayDoor.com. That's BeckwayDoor.com. Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
Maybe you've been hearing a lot about the need to make a spiritual communion while participating from home in a live-streamed or broadcast Mass. Maybe you've even prayed the prayer of spiritual communion. Spiritual communion is a concept that goes all the way back to the 4th century. It flourished in the Eastern Church and gradually moved west. Spiritual communion stresses the transcendence of God, where we unite our desires, intentions, and loves with the holy sacrifice of the Mass and the consecration of the Eucharist at the altar. Jesus, I embrace you and unite myself wholly to you.
Strained or broken relationships are a given in most of our lives. Friends fall away, siblings drift apart, children sever ties with their parents, and despite our best efforts, these painful fissures are difficult to mend. Hi, I'm Dr. Ray. If you want to learn how to communicate better with the difficult people in your life and be a more easygoing, more forgiving person, check out my book, How to Get Along with Almost Everybody. Check it out. And all my other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
God isn't content to love us from a distance. That's why he emptied himself, was born a man, walked among us, suffered, died, and rose again. That's why, having ascended to the Father, he gives us the sacraments, all so that we can experience his extravagant love through our senses. Being generously and appropriately affectionate with our kids is an important way to teach them about Christ's own embodied, extravagant love. There's nothing stingy or reserved about the way God loves his children, you and me, and we're called to love our children as demonstratively as he loves us. To discover more ways your family can celebrate the liturgy of domestic church life, check out the newest editions of Parenting with Grace and visit CatholicCounselors.com. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Honey, did you ever call Mighty Dog Roofing of Ann Arbor for that free roof inspection?
I knew I forgot something.
Roof leaks can cause mold buildup or even roof collapse. Protect your family today by calling local Catholics Dan and Mary Flanagan at Mighty Dog Roofing for a free inspection of your roof, siding, or windows. Mighty Dog Roofing, 734-224-4916. That's 734-224-4916.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States.
consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm talking with Joseph Stewart, professor of history and fellow in Catholic studies at the University of Mary in Bismarck, North Dakota, author of Christopher Dawson, A Cultural Mind in the Age of the Great War. I'd greatly encourage you to pick up a copy of it. So, Joseph, when we left off, we had just begun talking about the impact of Dawson's political theory. And so I want to ask you to comment just briefly about Edmund Burke's realism and how it influences how Dawson thinks about political function and a political philosophy.
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, Edmund Burke was the great British politician of the late 1700s who famously defended the Americans when we were having our revolution. Mm-hmm. He was one of the great British figures who agreed with Americans that Americans should be independent, or at least a lot freer than we were under the British. So he's a great figure, and it really the beginning of the kind of the conservative intellectual political tradition. And Burke has influenced many since, and one of which was Dawson. Dawson was reading Burke during the 1930s when right. the totalitarian Nazism and communism was happening, and he needed some inspiration. He needed some guidance, and he turned to Burke's great book, The Reflections on the Revolution in France. And I just want to say about this that Burke, you know, was an active politician, but he was also a thinker. So kind of theory and practice went together. That's what makes Burke so great, I think. And there's this one quotation, it's very brief, one sentence, I'll just read it to you, and I want to explain why this is significant for Dawson. Because Burke wrote in that book, he said, "Metaphysic rites entering into common life, like rays of light which pierce into a dense medium, are by the laws of nature refracted from their straight line."
Right.
So what Burke meant here, I think, and Dawson appreciates in Burke, is that truth, principle, when we're talking about politics, principle is unchanging, for sure, but it's refracted into life. It's bent into the world because of the dense atmosphere of our lives, of the chaos of culture, of the fact that human beings are not purely spiritual beings. We are also part animal, right. And we live messy, emotional, conflictual lives often. And so when truth enters into our little humanity, it bends and refracts. And this means that there's no automatic relation between a principle and a policy, right? We can't just say, okay, here's a truth, therefore, boom, this is a good policy.
Right.
Right? there's always ways in which if we really try to insist on the principle, we may end up creating a policy which actually undermines the principle.
Right.
Because of the seeking for justice in a way that's completely single-minded, can neglect other things and create a situation which is even more injustice. I mean, the history of the 20th century is the perfect case of this, the constant sort of totalitarian kinds of regimes. So in other words, there has to be a respect for freedom. We have principles. They're true. We want to implement them as well as we can. You know, the abortion area, I think, is one key area where we can think about this. And there'll be disagreement on this among people of goodwill, and that's fine. But I think me and I think Dawson, too, would side on the fact that, look, we need good laws that protect life. It's okay for now to settle for laws that are imperfect.
Right.
Let's try to move forward and get better laws, right, as time goes on. But there has to be a kind of prudence, because if there isn't, then we can end up losing the good that's already present.
That's right. That's right. And that's why a proper intellectual paradigm about social issues is crucial. It's not, there's a hierarchy of moral problems, that some things do in fact hold greater moral gravitas than others. And when we understand that rightly, social cohesion, you know, this, as Dawson would call it, this discipline, right, this social discipline that binds us together by means of a common cause, that's what draws us in terms of virtue towards making policy decisions for the common good.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that I want to mention quick that this essay that we're talking about, The Medium of Culture and Political Theory by Dawson, is available online. People can search the title, and it's available for free, published by the Acton Institute in their Religion and Liberty magazine. And you may be interested to know that this essay originated in a talk that I gave last November for the G.K. Chesterton Academy of Our Lady of Guadalupe, just north of Detroit, in collaboration with the Russell Kirk Center, another great Michigan institution.
Yeah.
And so, anyway, I just wanted to mention that.
Well, I'm really glad you did. And it's a great piece. I greatly enjoyed reading it. And in light of what you've highlighted in this piece, I think one of the things we need to understand is that Dawson was also compelled by historical events at his time, and he saw the fragility of liberalism, and he also saw post-liberalism, or at least his diagnosis of post-liberalism. Okay, can you talk about that briefly?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a fascinatingly relevant topic, right, because we've got Patrick Deneen's recent, very well-known book on the death of liberalism and things, and so we have a lot of concern today for a post-liberal kind of future. I very much disagree with that analysis. But I think here's the point, is that Christopher Dawson, much like us today, lived through a time in which there was a lot of cultural pessimism, and people were really down on the state of the culture. You know, he'd lived through the First World War. He was living through the Great Depression. He's seeing the rise of Mussolini and Hitler and Stalin. And in his view, it seemed, at least in the early 1930s, that the liberal tradition was over. It was dead. And that Britain and America would be next, and we would be in a new age of kind of strongman regimes and things. But what's interesting is that that post-liberal lens through which he read, you know, like Quadragesimo Anno and the Catholic social teaching, well, that began to shift, though, because as we reach a crisis point in World War II, he started to realize that, well, wait a second, maybe there are things in the British political tradition and the American tradition that are still alive and still valuable, and that maybe they're worth defending, and that maybe the post-liberal analysis was a little premature and not entirely true either, because it treated all the political regimes as if they're the same, like all basically flawed, and we just have to resolve, you know, to have a powerful dictator to kind of sort it out. And Dawson began to rethink the way he was interpreting Catholic social teaching. So he began to, I think, read it in a little different way and realize, wait a second, that in Britain and America, the importance of the individual, dignity, freedom, religious freedom, limited government, you know, the old classical liberal tradition, he began to realize, had a deeper, actually, Christian influence, right? It goes back to the Middle Ages and the Magna Carta and the whole development of Western civilization, that just maybe it's a valid, I'm not saying the only, but certainly a very valid and valuable expression of Christian principles played out in the English-speaking political tradition that is worth defending. And Dawson realized that during the Second World War, and his political thought reflects that slight shift, I believe, and I think that has something important to teach us today, too.
Yep, I couldn't agree more. And so when we're revisiting Dawson's writings and we're thinking about these issues, I think one of the things we can understand is Dawson is trying to draw our minds to the reality that some of these permanent structures, if I may borrow from Russell Kirk's own thought, these structures of, you know, the fundamental model of the family and even the notion of elected government, these are things that are the heritage of a free society and a well-formed mind. They're not given to us by the government, and it's incumbent upon a well-formed culture to preserve these things in right order.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And that's the place that natural law increasingly began to play in Dawson's political thought in World War II. And because he realized that there is this realm that's above the sphere of culture, which informs the culture, maybe refracted, like Burke said, maybe refracted indirectly, and it's never perfect, but it informs it, and we have to maintain our grounding in natural law. And so this brings about a shift. I think I mentioned in the essay here that Catholics, you know, kind of used to talk about like the ideal of the Catholic state and the rights of the church and things, but through their experience of the totalitarianism and working together with other common interests and people who weren't necessarily Catholic, Catholics started to shift their language from talking about the rights of the church to human rights.
Right.
And that has become, I mean, look at the papacy now. I mean, who could have predicted 120 years ago that the Pope would be a leading global defender of human rights, not just of Catholics, but of everybody? Who could have predicted that happening? This is an astonishing thing that's never really been seen in history that I'm aware of, at least. And I think Dawson's thought and his political thinking was directly on track with that,
right?
Because the church was becoming, in a sense, fully Catholic in the mid-20th century, because suddenly we have native bishops being consecrated in China and India and across the whole world. We have native bishops. The church is becoming truly global, and so that mindset had to begin to shift from this kind of old European sort of political models to, no, now we have a global framework, and we have to stand up for the human dignity of every person.
And because of this, going back to that conversation of, like you mentioned, it's not just that the Catholic Church has come to the forefront of the dialogue on human rights, it's that the church has embraced the reality that the conversation of truth has to be had at all fronts, and the church has to be the leading voice. And so, again, you're looking at Dawson talking about culture being inseparable from education, because that work has to continue in all facets of society.
Yeah, that's right. And I think one of Dawson's last and one of his greatest books that I teach to my students every spring is called The Crisis of Western Education.
Yeah.
It's 1961. It's an incredible book that's been republished by Catholic University of America Press recently here. And I just recommend it to all of your listeners. It's a very good book. And especially the last four chapters of that book are really profound. And they really get at what you just said there, that culture is a form of enculturation. Education is a form of enculturation, which just means the handing on of a culture.
Right.
And part of that is the faith, obviously, the spiritual side of culture. But you also have the material side of culture, and the how to eat well and how to take care of yourself and all those kinds of things. So that's all part of enculturation. But in the middle is this kind of formal enculturation called education. And part of that must be this heritage and this legacy of our place, our country, and the ways that the church has interacted with American culture since the late 18th century, and seeing how the church has worked hand in hand to build up Catholic schools and Catholic institutions in this country, and understanding the importance of that for our political regime.
Joseph, I really enjoyed connecting with you. Thank you for making the time.
I enjoyed it so much too, Dr. Peter. Thank you so much.
My guest has been Joseph Stewart, professor of history and fellow in Catholic studies at the University of Mary in Bismarck. And we've been talking about the lessons that you and I can still learn today from the political thinker, Christopher Dawson, the Catholic political thinker. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter.